my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. His name is Mitch, and he says, get a big book, a sponsor, work the steps, and get on with the business of living.
My name is Mitch. I'm an alcoholic. I think I was born that way. Either that or when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. I was born in Exeter, 1961. Yep. Monarch pride. Okay. I really had a rather normal upbringing. My biological father had problems with alcohol, and just like we said, we don't like to pronounce any man an alcoholic, but he definitely had problems with relationships, employment, incarceration, and stuff. But I was raised by a stepdad, and I'm very thankful for that. He and my mom married when I was like in the fourth grade. Once again, very normal, middle class upbringing. I was good in school, good in sports. Totally normal. We moved out to Eastern Visalia. I guess I was probably about sixth grade or so, and my life became a lot more rural and stuff. I mean, typical stuff. I went out and hunted with my shotgun, kind of a country boy. Rode horses, started a rodeo. And everything was fun. And I guess I drank alcoholically somewhere in, 7th, 8th grade. I want to say I was like 12 and a half years old and drank alcoholically. Set out to get drunk and accomplish the deal. And I think from that point, that would have been the start of the progression of my alcoholism right there. I could drink like a gentleman. Hats off to me. I had to be because my buddy, he was losing his lunch over by the fence, white as a ghost or whatever, and I just had a good old Southern comfort buzz and a little more confident and really liked the way I felt. That started junior high, we'd always found a way to get alcohol. We'd stand out in front of stores to have somebody buy it for us. Every once in a while, we'd have to give what I perceived as an alcoholic, some wino or somebody that's willing to buy for us a buck or a beer or something. And it's confidence, it's at the make out feel out parties in the seventh grade, being somebody's somebody's garage, or the parents would be in the other room, or if we're lucky, the parents would be out for dinner, and they'd usually shut down about 11 o'clock, and we'd stash stuff out in the bushes and go about our way. Pretty harmless stuff. High school came, and freedom grew, and the disease progressed, and really started to progress. I wasn't driving yet, but kids at school drove, and there were always little county stores. It was back in the good old days, I guess, or a more simpler time. We could go out by Linnell Camp and buy it. We could buy it in Goshen. And I was 15 years old. I looked like I was 12, but I had no problem getting alcohol. It just progressed. One night, I played freshman football, which ended up being the last football career of, last year I ever played the game. I was good at football, but I'd already discovered rodeo, and it never really dawned on me at the time, but rodeo brought more alcohol, more access to alcohol. There was an ice chest in the back of most of the parents' trucks, and the older boys would bring a bottle behind the buck and shoot, so a little more liquid courage. And I enjoyed it. It was quite fun. I was an adrenaline junkie and drank. drank more than your normal 15-year-old. Then I had a big rivalry game at here in Visalia. There was only two major high schools. It's called the Cowhide. We went to a friend's house. You know, I was hanging out with everybody who was older. They had their own apartment. And I found out what a Boilermaker was, you know, beer and whiskey at the same time. And, you know, I'm going to back down. Plus, I could drink like a gentleman anyway. And so we did that and set out to the football game. And I was pretty smashed by the time we got to the football game. So I ran into a friend. We can't go there. Long story short, turn around running from the security guards, which led to the Visalia Police Department, and that was my first alcohol-related arrest at 15 years old. Threw up in the back of the cop car. Yeah. I wasn't much like a gentleman that night, you know. So I quit. I gave it up. I did. I never went to another Redwood High School football game. And I didn't drink Boilermakers from that day forward. But it wasn't long before my disease progressed. I think there was a drunken disorderly in there. And, you know, it was, boys will be boys, you know. And so I think my mom and I went down to a little court hearing, still a minor, and $25 fine and nothing really on my record, time served. And when I was 17, I had another little brush with, this one was a highway patrol, and I was booked for Grand Theft Auto and drunk driving. And the first time I actually spent the night there, woke up, the guy was doing his business on the stainless steel toilet, and I just said, what the fuck am I doing here? And I'll never forget the look on my mother's face, and she said, I don't think I can get you out of this one. It was Saturday morning, and I don't know if it was a three-day weekend or whatever, but my chances didn't look good till about Monday morning, whatever, but I was out of there in an hour and 15 minutes. I could straighten it all out, and I got home. Went to court, and I got charged with speeding under prevailing conditions. I'll never forget it, you know. I mean, nobody was really taking anything serious, me especially, but the judge looked at my mom and said, well, I don't want your insurance rates to go up, and I think the blood alcohol was like 0.1 or something, and he only blew a 0.14, so he wasn't really too drunk, and I don't really want to give him a reckless driving, so we'll give him a ticket of speeding under the prevailing conditions, and it was like a $45 or $50 fine, and I mean, it's a lot more money than it is today, but it was basically just, you know, try to be nice and when you go out and play, and I asked my mother, well, what's speeding under the prevailing conditions? And she said, well, it was raining that night. You know, you're probably going too fast for the rain. You know, it never dawned on anybody that I was drunk off my ass. I was driving a stolen vehicle. And my punishment back in those days were, well, you know, you go feed the cows. Well, I was feeding the fucking cows anyway, you know what I mean? Okay. It gave me a place to take a nap, you know, when I was hanging. Just get up on top of the haystack. And so my disease progressed. You know, when I came here, there's a lot of the sayings the old timers hate. One of them was drinking career, but, you know, and it's more will be revealed or a moment of clarity. And I really didn't like the drinking career, but looking back now, you know, I made a career out of it. You know, so by the time I was 18, I set out to be a professional drunk, and I did a pretty good job at it. You know, my tags were always up to date. Every light on my vehicle worked. No cracks in the windshield, you know. I might not change the oil for 35,000 miles, you know, but I wasn't getting pulled over. I lived a rural life, and I could drive from Exeter to Strathmore or the other direction to Orange Cove without touching the pavement except for the cross from one dirt road to the other dirt road. And really progressed. 1981, New Year's Eve, I was with my cousin who was my best friend, my partner. I mean, just grew up together. We're about 40 or 50 days apart in age, and it's New Year's Eve. So, of course, you know, somebody had a New Year's Eve party. It was out north of Isaiah. And I was drinking a felony bottle of Kessler's, playing pool, and drinking like a gentleman. And my cousin and the other guy I was with, they were drinking the keg beer, and they got completely smashed. And so I drove and dropped my friend off, and I went home to where my cousin's truck was, and you know, I didn't want him to drive, and I struggled with him, but he's about 6'6 and about 260 pounds, and not a lot of body fat, and I couldn't get the keys away from him, and he's flinging me around, and he made it about a mile and a half from my house, and hit another drunk driver. And he was in a coma for 20 days. And I was floored. They woke me up whiskey drunk about an hour after I'd laid down and run down to the hospital and just to see him there. And I was in shock probably for pretty much that day. So, you know, I set out to give it up. And even after all of that, you know, I think I made it to 30 or 35 days. He woke up about 20 days later, permanently disabled for this crash, but I could stay sober for about 30 or 35 days. And then the thoughts in my head, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. You know, it's everybody else. And guys can't handle their alcohol. Lightweights, pussies, whatever you want to say, you know. And it was... And that's why I say I was born an alcoholic, you know, or when I took the first drink, because it's my whole childhood. And, you know, or what should have been my childhood, let's put it that way. And 1985 is significant, it's 4 years later. And it's when I started my last binge of alcohol. 29 years. I drank from 1985 to 2014. It's a little binge. And I guess I get my notes out, huh? But I wrote these down at 5:59. I can't. But that's kind of towards the end of what it was like. There's still a lot more of what it was like. But you know, I had a relationship, had a little stepdaughter, and neither one of us were ready. That didn't work, and she was the best ex-wife that, you know, that's ever been on the planet, because she kept 3,000 miles between her and I ever since it we split up. She went to Hawaii, and then last I heard, she's in North Carolina. If she's getting closer, I'm sure somebody will call. I ended up in another relationship, you know, drinking every day, pretty out of control, and then my boys started coming, and God bless them. My oldest little Mitch was born in 1992, and, you know, every time each one of them were born, I remember just like it was yesterday, and every one of them. And I was, you know, there at the hospital, and I was always going to straighten up. You know, I'm a dad. I had a good job, a good career, and everything, but I was just totally out of control. You know, totally out of control. Everyday drinker, everyday drunk. And then Trevor came in 93, and same thing. And then, you know, in my mind, I was always telling myself what a good father. I was coaching basketball, you know. I went to every parent-teacher conference, and there was alcohol, you know, all throughout that time. I mean, taking Dentine before you go to a parent-teacher conference, it was, you know, and drinking on the way to a parent-teacher conference, on the way back, drinking to and from everywhere with the kids in the car. You know, I was at a meeting the other night, and this speaker, he spoke of kids looking at him and, you know, putting the L, loser, you know, and it was quite a pitch, but, you know, it made me think, those were my kids, you know, and looking back, you know, I could see it in their faces. They were having to cover my back instead of the other way around, you know. Trevor was getting questions, you know. I was coaching him in basketball. And how come your dad always smells like beer and he's in a good mood, you know? And Trevor would have to, I don't know, kick his ass or tell him, how come your dad's always in a bad mood and he's an asshole, you know? I mean, and that to me, looking back, was my incomprehensible demoralization. It, you know, and thank God it's not like that today. But as a result of that, you know, little 29-year spree and 10 years of serious drinking to that, I really started having some medical issues. And Michelle, my girlfriend, was in my life then, and I was totally out of control. I mean, it was, you know, the beer wasn't cutting it. You know, beer was more like a breakfast mint or something, you know, or pork chop in every can, get rid of the shakes, and Jack Daniels and Sky Vodka and everything, that had pretty much done it. I just progressed. I used to love going to Costco because they had those cheap felony bottles, you know, and holidays, you know. But one day Michelle hugged me, and I wouldn't be here today without you, honey, and there ain't a doubt in my mind. But, and I had a man boob. It was my left breast. It's swollen. It's about the size of maybe a golf ball, maybe between a golf ball and a tennis ball. And that kind of caught my attention because my mother's a breast cancer survivor. And so, I mean, I went to the doctor, you know, for the first time in a long time. I usually just went unless I had something broken or something needed to be stitched. And they didn't know, but Michelle's in the medical field, and she knew the guy that did my imaging, and they kind of diagnosed it before I even heard anything from the water. It's called gynecomastia, and it's directly related to the liver. And still, you know, I didn't think of that. About that time, I had turned yellow for the first time, jaundice colored, and just like the good chapter 3 alcoholic that I was, you know, I had a solution for that. And my defiant self said, well, I'll just give up the hard stuff and started drinking only natural wines, you know. And before really the gynecomastia was even diagnosed, I went on my last bender. And I mean, I told you about the first bender, you know, on our steel horses, Schwinn, and I think his was Raleigh, you know. And in my last bender, my sister from Colorado Springs was out, and her husband. It was a good time. And yeah, I had been tapering off, you know. I knew something was going way fucking wrong. But I, you know, I was barbecuing, and you know, you got to watch the fire, you know, and watch the fire with your right hand, you know, good 24-ounce beer in your left hand. It was fun times. I loved my sister and my brother-in-law, and you know, I cooked, and I laid down, And my heart kicked up. And it had been kicking up, but it kicked up, scary kicked up. I mean, before I'd even tell Michelle, Michelle's flipped out of this fucking maniac she's hanging out with. Because it would kick up, but self-seeking, self-motivating, I could always get it to relax after about half an hour, an hour, you know. And this time it kicked up for a week, and I was scared, and I called the doctor's office about every day that week, and if we have any cancellations, you get in, you know, my heart's coming out of my chest. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Knox, you know, when we get a cancellation, so I had a regular appointment due to the boob deal, and so I went in about a week later, heart's still racing. And I walked right by the sign that said walk-ins welcome, you know, a week later. And, yeah, I wasn't welcome nowhere back in those days, I guarantee it, you know. But, so I came in this doctor, and the doctor, she's got her lab sheet and stuff, and a real serious look on her face. And I said, you know, did they tell you about my heart? We'll get to that. So I let her talk. She goes, well, your liver enzymes are through the roof, and your cholesterol's a little high, and she's going through this deal. And and she goes, well, I put you on this medicine, but it's not good for your liver. And I'll never forget, she pointed her finger at my face and said, but she won't quit drinking. And, you know, down the road early in sobriety, I really had a resentment towards that because, you know, my ego, when I got about a month, you know, who's that bitch think she's fooling with? You know, I got a month sober. But she was right. She was right. I want to get sober. And so she finally got chewing me out for, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and your liver, and just. And then I told her, can we get back to the heart? And she, we got an EKG machine. We can do that right here. Well, you want to listen, you might want to plug it in, you know. And I was laying there on my back, and the gal did the EKG, and I could hear her walk back to, you know, rip the paper out like the old printers used to do, you know. And as she walks back, and then I'm laying there looking at the ceiling, and then I hear a set of footsteps coming back on the floor about like that, hard floor. And so I look my head up, what's up? Oh, the doctor wants another one. Oh, there's something going on. The doctor wants another one. It'll just take a minute. They did that. And then I hear two steps kind of running down the hall. And so they unplug all the wires and stuff. And the doctor said, you know, right now you need to either go to the emergency room or go to a cardiologist. And you know, that's pretty heavy stuff. So I said, well, you know, my girlfriend works at a cardiologist. I'll go there. And, you know, you want an ambulance? Can you drive everything? I was, yeah, right, you know. Give me a couple pills. This will be just nothing but a blurb, you know. So I called Michelle, and I'm sure she was flipping out. And I drove into her work. And then her doctor did another EKG. I brought copies of the other one. And he thought they could treat it with prescriptions, and I thought that was fine. So he gave me some prescriptions, and they gave me the samples to take, and then Michelle was going to pick it up. So I thought I was fine. So I stopped and got a 3-pack of those 24-ounce beers, you know, equivalent to a 6-pack. And that was a blast. I had fucking fun that day, you know. I'd take these pills, and we have one of those blood pressure deals, and I'd watch my blood pressure and my pulse rate go down. You know, hey, that's cool, you know, drink a little more beer. I'm watching this machine, so hell, I was cured. You know, I was cured. And so then it got kind of scary low, and I had to go back the next day, and they took it, and so I had to wait. And they gave me another test, a nuclear stress test, and then they found block blockage in one artery, and they kind of took me off of one of the pills, and 9 days later they were going to do the angioplasty or gram, whatever they call it, and they put a deal on, and I got a stent, and there's another 24 hours of sobriety too, is in Quidelta Hospital. Michelle was the only one to come and see me, and she wanted to bring me in, and I didn't ask, but I did ask her to stop on the way home the next day, and I did. Well, when I was in the hospital with the stent, I turned yellow or jaundice again, and they think it was, you know, a reaction to something. So her doctor, you know, right after we got through bombing the shit out of his country, basically saved my life. The doctor I was working with, they ordered a CAT scan. Okay, I need to speed up. I was worried about being able to talk for 45 minutes. Y'all got an extra half an hour? But, so I was diagnosed with cirrhosis on July the 22nd, something like that, 2014. I really didn't know it. I knew it wasn't good. And Michelle doesn't even know this, but I grabbed 2 24-ouncers and drove home with the zit. You know, I can't drink anymore. And I got another month, or maybe not quite a month, out of that. And I was doing a little work for this job I had. I mean, still in good graces with them and stuff, and they needed some extra help, a little monitoring of some of their stuff. And I went out there, like, in late August, and I don't know how to say this any other way, but I was fucking sick. I mean, I was losing lunch, throwing up blood. Every joint in my body hurt, pain. And so I did what an alcoholic did, and I tried one more time to control my drinking. And I was just drinking, like, 2 beers a day, or basically a half of a Grande, a beer a day, and I did that for 5 days. I threw a can under the seat on the last day. My heart had kicked up again, right back to where it was, you know, 115, 125 or something on the deal. Michelle found the can, and I think it maybe a little spiritual awakening. I probably left the can there. Just I saw the pain in her face, and so I set it out to give it a whirl. We ended up at the University of San Francisco, and anyway, I know I need to speed it up, but through everything for the next year, I did get qualified, and thanks to y'all, I did get a liver replacement on August the 7th of this year, or 2015. And no, the reason I say thanks to y'all, because you're the one where I learned a God of my understanding. You were the ones that welcomed me when nobody else would welcome me. You're the ones that loved me when I couldn't love myself. But I'm going to go back into that. So, anyway, the cirrhosis. But I was about 19 or 20 days sober from that last bit. I took my last drink of alcohol on August the 28th. My sobriety date's August 29th, 2014. I'm sorry. I feel bad because I think I read the newsletter, and I think I screwed the whole month's average up. You know, you'd had a whole lot more years if they had somebody up here besides me talking. But anyhow, and on the way back, and I'd already did make a commitment to myself, and more importantly, Michelle, that, you know, I was going to do whatever I had to do to quit drinking. And the last recommendation by the University of San Francisco was Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had wanted me to go to, like, a big-time inpatient deal, and But Alcoholics Anonymous, what I could afford. Thank God I did. That was a spiritual awakening right there. And then when I heard about the no dues and fees, that was good because I'm still a tight ass son of a bitch, you know. But, and I'd gone to, you know, a couple meetings, but really what the game changer was for me is I tried a meeting and it was on Bridge Street. It was a Wednesday night and I went, it was a very small book study meeting or whatever, and I was there, so I introduced myself, and there I kind of told them, you know, what had been going on and what was going on. And I was just at the beginning of the cirrhosis. I was sick, but it would be a wild ride farther than that. But then the next morning I came in and I came into Bridge Street drunks, and they haven't kicked me out yet. And I can still remember the people that were in that room that morning. And I mean, it's really mind-boggling. And you know, the book says that God speaks to, well, I don't know who says it, but I feel that the God of my understanding speaks through the group conscience, and it was it. I mean, it was a great group, great sobriety, and for the first time in my life, I wanted what somebody else had that didn't include like a wife, a girlfriend, a truck, a gun, you know, or some kind of deal. I mean, I wanted that. Wanted that. It's just a group. I mean, I can't say enough about them. So, and for the first time in my life, I followed suggestions. And I love the part in the Daily Reflection that says, you know, these suggestions. And it says they're like, if you jump out of an airplane with the parachute, you suggest you pull the cord. But I learned so much about myself and so much about sobriety and so much, and I want it as bad then, I mean as bad today as I do then. Michelle could tell this story better than I am, but I found out that the center biggest condition that caused me to be an alcoholic is me. I'm self-centered, self-seeking, self-motivating, dishonest. And I had to find out the how and why of it. These are both on page 62, that first of all, I had to stop playing God. It didn't work. I knew I was an alcoholic when I got here, but I didn't know what an alcoholic was till I read the doctor's opinion. And then I realized I needed a psychic change. I never thought that I had an allergy to alcohol, but when it talked about the phenomenon of craving and what happens there, then yeah, I knew I was in the right place. So, step one, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I was so defiant, I still didn't realize my life was unmanageable until he said, killing yourself ain't managing your life very well, son. Step two, come to think a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. There had to be a power greater than myself. I mean, I was knocked to oblivion, you know. I had definitely hit my bottom physically, mentally, morally, spiritually. But there was still a trap door, and the Bridge Street folks, y'all, I mean, you guys are all my heroes. Every one of you want to let me hit that trap door. When I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I mean, all the steps were so huge, but I wasn't running the fucking show no more. And it gave me so many tools, you know. And I live them today, you know. If I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. You know, I need to accept life on life's terms. Not the center of the universe anymore, you know. Step four. You know, my sponsor's a Native American. Sworn enemy to cowboys everywhere. So, step four, you know, he gave me all this stuff, and whatever you do, don't let no one find it, you know, especially your wife. Okay. Well, we hit that about the holidays, you know, so I was wanting to do the fifth step, you know, get my fourth step out and do it all for them. Well, I'm a little busy today, and so I hid my fourth step from myself about 17 times during that. I think the cruel old sucker got a kick out of it, but I come up with these little country boy slogans, you know, the fourth and the fifth step to me, I'd call it unload to reload, you know, just like a New Year's resolution, just out with the bad, in with the good. I've come to learn so much. I've come to the point where I don't regret my past, nor do I wish to shut the door upon it. Because I want to be here today. I want to be here today without so many of you that I love so much that picked me up and gave up on me when it was me and Michelle against the world. The people that I drank with, they really didn't want to come around because the normal ones didn't want to see me kill myself. The abnormal ones knew I didn't have any more. The people that loved me didn't want to be there to see me as sick as I was. The people at Bridge Street welcomed me and loved me every day, no matter what. And I loved them right back. Time to get the notes out again. I've done pretty good without looking at these notes. I don't know when alcohol stopped being a luxury and started becoming a necessity. But it does. And if it hasn't happened to you yet, it will. And it did. For many of those 29 years on my last little spree, we read it every meeting, is the idea that somehow, someday, I would be able to control and enjoy my drinking was my great obsession. And I did pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. Even coming into AA, you know, I knew nothing about it, but, you know, I was still thinking, no matter how that, well, 90 days, you know, that's how I come in and stuff. But then again, I was falling, starting to ramble now. I'll let you get rid of me. There's no way. I didn't like the term grateful alcoholic when I got here, because it's just like the gift of desperation, which I surely had. You know, I was thinking, gift, yeah, what a gift. You know, I got dealt the wrong card. But if it wasn't for the gift of desperation, I don't think I would have been ready. I know I would have never met you guys. I don't think I would have worked so hard. Thanks to my sponsor, it didn't seem like work. It's the best thing I ever did. I'm going to close with this. At the end of Dr. Bob's nightmare, and I'm going to paraphrase it. I mean, I planned on reading it. I got my little big book. But it says, if you are atheist or agnostic or a skeptic, or have any form of intellectual pride that keeps you from believing that's what in this book, that he feels sorry for you. And if you accept what's in this book, in this program, with half the zeal that you did to take your drinks, that I did to take my drinks, and believe me, that was my first going to any length, was going to get those drinks. And he likes my chances. I believe everything in this book. Today, I stay close to the program. I stay closer to my book. I stay closest to the guy in charge, God, as I understand him. Thank you all. God bless you.